Hey, Travi. I'm happy to give this talk. So I'm going to be talking about some work I've been doing with John, and it's going to be based on these two papers put on the archive recently. So this is going to be about post-quantum cryptography. Okay. So post-quantum cryptography means many different things to many different people. Okay. And I just wanted to add a little bit more confusion by having my own definition of what post-quantum cryptography is. So I'm going to be looking at cryptography in settings that are more general than quantum. Okay, so in GPTs, generalized probabilistic theories. Okay. Again, if there's any questions, just feel free to jump in at any time. Ravi, already.
I thought post-quantum cryptography was like classical cryptography, resilient to quantum attacks or something like that.
Okay. Okay, I guess I asked for this question. Okay. So there's post-quantum cryptography, the way most people use it, everyone except myself, is once we have universal quantum computers, they're going to be safe against these kind of attacks. So you can have classical algorithms for which there's no quantum algorithms known that can break it.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that a little bit later. Or you could also think of quantum algorithms, quantum cryptography that's secure against quantum algorithms as well. Okay. People usually use the term quantum safe cryptography now, just to, but I wanted to be kind of cute. I put brackets here, so this is really post-quantum cryptography. Okay, so what am I talking about? So here's a couple slides just to give you the flavor of what's happening. So I'm going to be talking about these generalized probabilistic theories, GPTs. Okay, and this is what I've gathered after working a few months with John. It's a bunch of convex things that interact with other convex things in some kind of linear way. Okay. I'll get a slightly more technical, but that's the idea. Okay. So we have, okay, it's kind of hard to tell. We have convex, and we have linear. And these are kind of like the key features. Cone programming. Okay. So this is, what I've been chatting with John about. So this is optimizing linear functions of convex things that satisfy some kind of linear conditions. Okay. Are you trying to figure out what he's working on there?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. If you go back and forth enough times, you'll see that there's lots of these nice, cool words in common. It's convexity, linearity, these kind of things. So you combine them together, and we're going to optimize GPT stuff. Okay. This is John and I. I think this is John just because of the hair, but I'll let you guys decide. Okay, so this is what we've been doing.
He's used to me.
Yeah. Okay, so this is kind of the foundation where we started thinking about this. So I spent some time thinking about semi-definite programming. Okay, and this is just a mathematical tool. Okay, it has nothing to do with physics or anything. It's really just a mathematical tool for optimization. But it lines up very nice to be used in quantum theory. Okay, so it seems like every day you open up the archive, you look at, if you bother looking at the abstracts, usually someone's using semi-definite programming in some kind of way. Okay. And there's nothing inherently quantum about semi-definite programming. It's just kind of everything kind of fits together really nicely. Okay, so it's a very useful tool. Okay. John was telling me, hey, look, it's just GPTs are just a little bit more general than quantum theory. We have convex structures, convex cones, all these nice things. I'm like, well, there's all these results in quantum theory that rely on this, but what people sometimes don't use is cone programming. Okay? So this is kind of like the analogous optimization class. And so this is the analogy, and this works very well for GPTs. Okay? So that's kind of the idea, generalizing this direction to this direction, see what happens, see what challenges arise, so forth. OK, so where do semi-definite programs appear? Well, in quantum alone, they're in cryptography, so what I did my PhD on. Complexity theory, query complexity, is more computer science-y. Information theory, looking at channel capacities and lots of channel stuff. Entanglement theory, if you want a nice, efficient approximation of the set of separable states, okay? Or LOC operations, or whatever, all these nasty sets, you can come up with these nice approximations. Graph theory is kind of a new area, and a couple of physics ones, and they're really across the board. Error correction, whatever area you work on, there's probably semi-definite programs used somewhere. Okay. So roughly, it'd be nice to see where cone programs could be used in these generalized versions of these things. Yeah, that's a very rough idea. OK, so what is a cone program? First, let me start with, what is a cone? Just to make sure we're all on the same page, we have a cone K here. Okay, this is going to be a set of vectors. And it's going to be closed under taking scalars of non-negative scalars. Okay? So if you have a point in the cone here, you can scale it as high up as you want, and it's going to stay in the cone. So this cone is going to go up forever. Okay, and this is the origin down here. So it can also be shrunk down to the origin. Okay, so that's a cone. We'll assume that they're mostly convex. So basically, this is filled in. Okay? So I'll just say cone, but I really mean convex cone. They're distinct ideas, but for the purposes of this talk, same thing. Okay, so we have a nice set of vectors. And we're going to optimize over the set of vectors. Okay? So we're going to have some kind of variable that we're optimizing. So this is what we're seeking. It's going to belong to some cone. All right? We have some kind of set of linear constraints, ax equals b. So a is a linear function here. So this is going to be a hyperplane that intersects the cone in some nice way. And you want to optimize, you can also minimize if you want, some linear function over that cone. Okay? And you can always write a linear function as an inner product as long as you're working in Hilbert space. Okay? So this is the algebraic. This is the geometric picture. Okay? So you have some kind of nice cone. You have some kind of hyperplane that's going to intersect in some non-trivial way, hopefully. Okay? You can cut it at any angle you want. So we have a cone that the variable has to live in, some affine slice. The intersection here is going to be the set of feasible solutions. We'll just call the set the feasible region. Okay? So geometrically, we want some linear function being optimized over this little chunk here. Any questions at this point? Yeah. OK, so here's a nice quantum example that we're going to be generalizing later, but just to kind of see the idea of what's happening. So this is optimal measurements. So suppose you're given one of n quantum states, rho 1 to rho n. You know what the states are. And each one is given to you with some kind of probability pi. Okay? And you know the probabilities and you know the states. But when it's given to you, you don't know what state you're given. Now the idea is we want to figure out some way to determine what state you're given, making the least error possible. Okay? So let's just go through the problem and see what we can do. So here's the data, or set of states. So we have the set rho I and pi. We know these. Okay? And this is all we know. What we can do, since we have to extract some classical information anyway, you measure it. Okay? So we have the set of POVMs here. And what we're going to do is this POVM is going to have n outcomes because there's n possible guesses for the state. So if you measure it, you get outcome I. You're going to guess the state that you're given was rho I. Okay? So that's how we're going to tackle it. Algebraically, we have these constraints. These m's have to add to the identity. And they have to be positive semi-definite. Okay? They have to be POVMs. Okay? And this is algebraically a complete description of what a POVM is. And what we want to maximize is this linear function. So with probability pi, you're given rho I. And with this inner product is the probability that you output the correct guess condition on given rho I. Okay? So we have an objective. We know what the constraints are. Just throw it all together into a nice optimization problem. And now we want to maximize this subject to this. This is a hyperplane constraint, and we have some cone constraints. Okay. And this is a cone program. This is actually a semi-definite program, because the cone right here is the set of positive semi-definite matrices. So cone program is more general than semi-definite programming. It's also more general than linear programming and a bunch of other nice classes of optimization problems. It's really the cone. Right. It's the cone. So you can always have some kind of nice linear function, whatever, and then you just change the cone however you want. And that's it. If this happened to be the set of non-negative vectors, then you get a linear program. And there's other nice cones out there. But...
the linear constraint in your cone program slide, was that an inequality?
I had it as equality.
An equality?
Yeah.
But in general, it would have to be an inequality to capture this case, would it not?
This is an equality right here.
Oh, I see. So the positivity condition is the one that's analogous to the
cone, yeah.
Belonging. to a
right, right. Roughly speaking, anytime you have a cone constraint, it's capturing the difficult part. Like you can always solve some linear system. It's just belonging to this cone's an estimator. You can also have inequality constraints. As long as you have two of them, then you can force the equality. You have less than or equal to or greater than or equal to, then they have to be equal. It is trivial. Yeah, yeah, everything.
Sorry, I'm not sure I understood the last comment. What do you mean if you have two of them?
Like if you have a constraint, say something like x equals y, you can always rewrite it as x less than or equal to y and x is greater or equal to y.
Sure, but why would you do that?
If you really want all your equalities to be inequalities.
Ah, okay, okay. But actually, usually it's the opposite. No, you like to, one would like to have equality
yeah.
constraints.
Right, right. Yeah, because whenever you start doing more, applying the theory of optimization, you really want some of these constraints to be strict sometimes,
yeah.
and then you run into problems.
So as a rule of thumb, you want as many of them to be equality.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Any other questions about this? So we don't know what the optimal value is of this. So there's some kind of value in having the optimization problem and being able to cast it as an optimization problem. Where I'm just not forcing this problem to be an optimization problem and then stopping. Like, we really don't know what it is. If there's two states, we can write it in terms of the trace distance and all this stuff. But if you have three or more, it's very hard. Yeah. So even, you know, this is hard even in quantum. But we'll make it harder in a second. OK, so what's a GPT? I'll go through this quickly, since I think most people know. I'm actually probably the least educated person to talk about this, but I'm going to try anyway. So physical states are vectors in the cone, okay? And measurements belong in a different cone E here. Okay? And we can define the measurements and the states kind of simultaneously by having this discarding or throwaway effect U here. U is going to live in the dual cone. And this hyperplane right here is going to be some kind of normalization on this set of physical states here. Okay? So this cone intersect this hyperplane, defined by this, it's going to be the set of physical states. Okay. But we're going to impose some extra conditions on these cones. One condition is that they're contained in each other's dual. So the dual cone is the set of vectors that make non-negative inner product with everything in that cone. Okay. So once you get this little star here, you think of all the things that make non-negative inner product. And we want that because the inner products are eventually going to correspond to probabilities. And probabilities, we want them to be non-negative. So we have a measurement. It's a set of vectors in here, the dual cone. They're going to add up to the discarding effect right here. So they're going to be, yeah, all of them are in the cone. They add up to U. And if you have that, then the probability of obtaining outcome I using the measurement is going to be this inner product, given rho k here.
Okay.
Yep.
So you're not defining u from the physical states, right? You're saying pick some u, and that defines the physical states.
So I'm designating some kind of vector in here as it's kind of like throwing away. In quantum, it's the partial trace,
yeah.
or trace. Once you have that, then you define the hyperplane defined like this. Inside this cone, and that'll give you the physical states. So I think of the discarding effect coming first. And the reason you have that is just so the probabilities add to one. So you have to kind of define things simultaneously such that the probabilities are non-negative and add to one. Mm-hmm.
Do you include in the constraint that the effects should not just be in the dual state space, but also below U?
Yes, implicitly. So all these guys have to be in the cone and then add to U.
Got it.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you have like a two outcome measurement, the one effect has to be between zero and U. Any other questions? Too fast? Sloppy?
It's not quite a question, but I'm sure you know that. So the last definition of measurement is actually an assumption. It's not necessarily true in every GPT. This thing is what we would call the no restriction hypothesis.
No. These are, sorry, this E is contained in K star. I'm not assuming they're equal.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
So it's
actually, yeah, I probably shouldn't have.
Theory would come with the specification of which measurements are allowed.
Yes, that's right.
Not necessarily all of them.
That's right. So I guess the specification is this cone here, and this discarding effect, and I think everything else is fine. Mm-hmm.
I think there is a second assumption here, which isn't the no restriction hypothesis, but you are saying that any set of effects is a physical measurement that can be done. It could also be that certain sets of effects just can't be performed together, even though each one individually is in the set of effects. But you're assuming that every
resolution of the identity is a valid measurement. That's the
yes. Yeah, I'm
assuming. It seems to me it's like a necessary condition on a set of E's, not a sufficient condition. Maybe it's not clear from the notation, but I was interpreting this. Any set of E's that do appear in a measurement have to satisfy this constraint, but not every set of E's that satisfies this constraint necessarily is a valid measurement.
Possibly. I haven't actually thought about that. John, what do you think? Feel free to jump in at any time.
I'll let you keep going.
Okay. Make me sweat up here. Okay. Okay. Yeah, please just comment as much as possible because I'm quite new to this and I really want to know how to think about these things. Okay, so. Right, so now we have proper probabilities. Okay, so cone programs and GPTs, you know, you flash back and forth between the slides, really the same thing's happening. You have a bunch of nice cones appearing, you have nice hyperplanes appearing. You know, so you could see how they're well suited for each other. Okay, so we have a setting, GPTs. We have a tool, which is cone programming. Now we need a problem, okay? And we're going to look at two cryptography problems, okay? So first, the grant proposal. Okay. So, you know, classical cryptography was good once upon a time, but, you know, as the world is now classical, quantum algorithms came along, and now we can break RSA by factoring, Shor's algorithm for factoring. We can break elliptic curve cryptography by discrete logarithms, and so forth, okay? Some classical cryptography has not been destroyed, but we'll talk about that later, okay? And quantum algorithms break some of classical cryptography, not everything, but a lot of them. But the reason to look at GPT cryptography is that cryptography is, whenever you read a quantum cryptography paper, they're assuming the validity of quantum mechanics, okay? So if someday, you know, some experiments happen, whatever, we realize, you know, something isn't quite right with the theory, we have to make some adjustments, we would really have to go back and kind of reassess all these papers, okay? So that's why I like looking at this post-quantum cryptography, because instead of basing it on an entire theory, we're going to be basing security on basic physical principles that we may think hold true even if the theory changes. Okay? Something like no signaling or no restriction hypothesis or whatever. Okay? And it also gives us a better idea of what's happening in the quantum cryptography. What are the basic principles of quantum theory that's allowing for the security to happen? Okay? Okay. So, you know, this is what you'd write in an introduction to a paper, but really, you know, the math is interesting, so this is the real reason we're doing it. Okay, so the first application is Big Commitment. So, we have Alice. Alice has a present for Bob. Here's Bob, but the problem is Alice is traveling during Bob's birthday and doesn't want Bob to open his gift until his birthday. Okay, so it's a very important problem. So what Alice is going to do, she's clever, she's going to put the present inside a safe, send the safe to Bob, and tell Bob, can't open the safe till his birthday. Okay? So Bob's birthday rolls around, Alice says, okay, here, Bob, mails him the key, or you could think of emailing a digital combination or whatever. Bob applies the key to the safe and gets his present out, and alas, gets his present. Okay? So, and he didn't open it up before his birthday, so everything is good. Okay. So, Big Commitment is kind of an information theoretic safe box. Okay. So, we want some kind of mathematical way to implement this safe box. And I guess the most important feature is that we did not want Bob to be able to open it up early. Okay? Now, we want to do this based on physical principles. Like, if Bob was super strong, he could just rip open the safe and get his present early. Okay? If it was a digital combination, he could just spam it, and maybe, you know, assuming the combinations weren't too many, get it before his birthday. Okay? This isn't physical security. Okay? This is just, you know, Bob can't be bothered to do this security. Okay? So let's find a way to actually lock the information away from Bob. So Alice is going to have A, so it's bit commitment. You can think of more general things, but Alice is just going to have a bit A. She's going to send, first she's going to create some bipartite state, SAB. So you can think of this as being a generalized probabilistic theory. So she has some physical state. It's on two systems, A and B. And so she's either going to create one or the other, depending on the value of A. She's going to send B over to Bob, currently, right now. And then later, whenever she feels like telling Bob what it actually is, she's going to say, OK, Bob, my state was actually A. And here's the rest of my physical state script A. Okay? What Bob is going to do is check if Alice tampered with it in the meantime. So he knows what A is at this point, because Alice told him. So he's going to have a two outcome measurement. And this measurement is going to accept the state if it was untampered from Alice. Okay? So with probability 1, under this measurement, going to accept this one particular state. Okay? We don't need this to be exactly 1. We can have it a little bit less. In quantum theory, usually if this is a pure state, you just project onto that pure state. So you can assume this is 1 quantum theory. We don't, but it's just going to make the slides a little nicer. Okay? Any questions about the setup? A big commitment in general? OK. So here are the two opposing goals. Bob should not learn Alice's bit early. So early means that after B is sent, B should contain no information of whether he's holding something corresponding to the bit 0 or the bit 1. Alternatively, Alice should not be able to change her bit before revealing. So right here, suppose Alice like, oh no, I wish I sent the A equals 0, but I sent A equals 1. She should not have the power to change that. Okay? So you can think of this, Bob should not be able to get his birthday present early, and Alice should not be able to, say, change the color of the car. Okay? It's kind of locked away. And these are opposing tasks. So if you don't want Bob to learn anything, Alice could just send no information here and then send it all later. But then she would have complete control, and she'd be able to change the value of A perfectly later because Bob would have nothing to go by. So these are kind of opposing goals. So how much can Alice or Bob cheat? Okay. So, okay, now we have cheating Bob. Bob is going to try to learn or infer some information about A from the system B alone. So he's going to measure the system in B, and he's randomly given either this reduced state or this reduced state. Okay. And this is exactly the state discrimination problem I stated earlier. Okay? And this is in the GPT setting. So we're just going to write this down. So 1/2 is the probability that he's given this state, and he has some kind of measurement outcome corresponding to that. And over here, 1/2 is the probability that he's given the other one. And this is the outcome that he's going to use to guess that he was given A equals 1. They have to add to the discarding effect, and they both live in some nice effect. Okay. So if you solve this on a computer or whatever, you have the optimal solution. These two vectors, E0 and E1, is exactly the measurement he would perform. Any questions about this? OK, so far? OK, so we're going to return to this. This is going to be kind of like the key idea behind the proof. But now we can look at how much Alice can cheat. Okay, so now we have rock and roll Alice over here. How is she going to cheat? Well, she's not going to choose A. She could if she wants, but she doesn't have to. And she has to send some system in B, because Bob's waiting for it. After which, she's going to randomly decide, uniformly at random, choose an A at this point, and try to convince Bob that A was sent. Okay? So she's going to send this A that she just chose now and send some system in script A and hopes to pass Bob's cheat detection. Okay? So she just wants it such that the joint state at the end has large inner product with this except. Okay? Because if Bob rejects, then she has zero probability of winning. Okay? So that's how Alice cheats. So the idea is, what's a good strategy for Alice? We already have some kind of nice optimization problem for how much Bob can cheat. But what's a good strategy for Alice? Well, we're going to show that one depends on a cheating Bob. May not be optimal, but it's going to be a decent strategy. Okay? And the idea is that we eventually want to show that this is impossible. Either Alice or Bob can cheat. Okay? So let's put cheating Alice on hold and re-examine Bob. So this is Bob's cheating probability. And I'm going to wave my magic wand and come up with a dual problem. Okay. So with every cone program, there's an associated dual cone program. I like putting the magic wand because it kind of appears out of nowhere and it's not clear how it relates. So you should not be able just to be like, oh yeah, that's the dual program. You should maybe believe me a little bit. You know, I can tell you the details later if you want. But it's defined in terms of the same parameters. So the data was, we have this state here, S0B and S1B. They're showing up over here. The cone over here is E. And now we have the dual cone showing up over here. And this U here is showing up here. Okay, so all the information in the original one is coming over here. But we're just kind of twisting it around to come up with a new optimization problem. And now X is the single variable here. Okay, so it's kind of a new perspective at looking at a cheating Bob. And you can show that this is actually equal to Bob's cheating probability. Okay? Under some conditions, I'm assuming E here is non-empty interior. Under that assumption, then these two guys will be equal. So this is almost useful, okay? But we're going to make it useful. It'd be really nice to have K instead of E star here, okay? So E star is a, so K is a subset of E star, okay? And I'll tell you why I want K there in a second, but I'm just going to go ahead and assume this, okay? So I'm going to assume E equals K star, and this is okay because other people do it too. Okay. And this is called the no restriction hypothesis. Okay. So now it's really okay because now it has a name. Okay. So under the no restriction hypothesis, I'm going to replace that E star with K. Okay. The no restriction hypothesis in this setting basically means that Bob has enough measurements at his disposal to learn what Alice's states are. Okay. So in some sense, we are giving him a little bit more measuring power. But why do we want K there? Well, this K is going to be the set of physical states. So these are the physical states that live on system B. So let's take an optimal solution X. This inner product is Bob's optimal cheating probability. Okay? And this U here is the discarding effect. So if we normalize it by this inner product, we have a physical state. This state here is in the cone, since we just scaled it a little bit. And we scale it such that it fits on that hyperplane. Okay? So now this is a physical state. And it lives on the system B. And the state has nice properties. So you know, just not just any old physical state. But X is, so when X minus something's in a cone, you can think of it conceptually that X is larger than this. Okay? So X is larger than the honest state for 0, and it's also simultaneously larger than the honest state for 1. Okay? So Alice is just going to use this state as her cheating probability, or cheating strategy. So this was a physical state, so that's something she can send. She's going to decide A later. Okay? And then she's going to send A and this subsystem script A here. But she's going to maintain a purification. So we're going to assume a so-called purification postulate. That means that this could be mixed or non-extremal, so she's going to keep up purification. If she does that, then this acceptance probability can be bounded. Since x was larger than these two honest states, or scaled versions of these honest states, then you just do some purification, play around with the cones a little bit, and you can show that Alice can use this strategy to cheat with probability at least this. Okay? So this normalizing condition here, xu, comes from this normalizing the state up here. Okay? So what can we take home from this? Well, we have a cheating strategy for Alice that succeeds with this probability, but this inner product was exactly how much Bob can cheat from this. Okay? So now we have some kind of trade-off curve between Alice and Bob's cheating probabilities, and you can show that neither of them could be less than, sorry, not both of them could be less than 70%, okay? Which is 1/√2. Well, roughly. Okay? So this is a no-go theorem. It says that either Alice or Bob can cheat with probability at least 1/√2 in any the commitment protocol of this flavor. Okay? And a similar result was shown by Carabella and company. Okay? And there's some slight differences. So our result also works for integer commitment. This A here need not come from a set of two elements. It could come from any set, finitely many elements. So something like integer commitment. So it also holds. This 2 just changes into an N, kind of magically. And their result also holds for bit commitment, but you can have interaction, which is quite a bit more general. Okay, so it's just like one message and then a second message in ours, where theirs has interaction. And they also have the purification postulate, but instead of using no restriction hypothesis, they use some other different physical principles. Okay, so I think purification postulate is really where the power is coming.
Okay. Is the quantum trade-off, best known quantum trade-off, the same trade-off?
No, so in my setting, with just one message than the other, then it equals 3/4. So you get 75% instead of 71%. So it doesn't saturate that. The way you get the 75% in quantum is the Fuchs van der Graaff inequality, or these kind of trade-offs between the fidelity and trace distance. And John and I spent some time thinking about the Fuchs van der Graaff inequality, but we weren't able to prove in the GPT setting. So this 1/√2 is kind of inspired by a lower bound on coin flipping, which is optimal for coin flipping. So Kateyev's lower bound for coin flipping has a 1/√2 here. So to...
It's conceivable that you could strengthen this result.
Yes, yes. There is a notion, you can have a Fuchs van der Graaff inequality for GPTs, but the problem is that the trace distances and the fidelities are all different now. They may not all be the same. Or in quantum, you have like 7 different definitions of fidelity that all conveniently are equal. In GPT, they're all different. Some are useful for bounding the scalar here, and some are useful for actually capturing how much Alice is cheating and can't quite connect the dots yet. But assuming we might eventually get something like that, this could increase. The 1/√2 can also be is not attainable if you have interaction in the quantum setting. So if the commit phase, there's many messages back and forth, then the optimal cheating probability is 73.9%, which is a little bit higher than this. Any other questions about bit commitment? I'm going to change tunes to another task. Okay? Okay, so unforgeable money. So this is another neat crypto task. And this doesn't use Alice or Bob anymore, it uses a banker and a pirate. Okay? So the banker is going to issue some money, send it out into the wilderness, and the wilderness is full of pirates. And the pirates, who really like money, just going to photocopy it, send it back to the bank, and the bank now has way too much money, and you know, the economy is destroyed. Okay, so we don't want this. So how can we stop this guy here from doing that? So is this possible? Well, here's the idea. There's the no-cloning theorem could make this impossible. If this were quantum money, then we could imagine this pirate not being able to clone it or counterfeit it. Okay? Classically, this is impossible because you can always perfectly counterfeit classical money. You know, but the reason why people can't do it now is technological reasons. You know, the bank or the mint will put all these, you know, stickers and holograms and diffraction gratings and all these neat things on the money to make it hard to build this machine. But in theory, you could always build it. Okay? Because you can copy classical information as much as you want. Okay? So we want to put some kind of physical states inside that money to make it impossible. And the idea is based on no cloning. But here's the problem, is that we need some kind of quantifiable notion of what it means to be no cloning. A bank can't just send one quantum state out into the wilderness, have two come back and be like, hey, no, these are two exact same quantum states. This is obviously a copy. The bank needs to somehow tell that these are the same state, right? You need to measure it, okay? So we need some kind of way to measure clonability. Okay, so this is the setting. So this is actually based on a paper by Stephen Wiesner back in the 70s. This is the very first quantum cryptography paper. And this was, I believe, there was two tasks in that paper. And I believe the quantum money was the first one. So this is really going back to the very first application of quantum cryptography. Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to select a state. So this is just some physical state now and some GPT. And you select it with probability pi. And you put it inside the money in some kind of way. I don't know how. And you send it back to the pirate. Okay. Now here's where the key is. The banker knows what the state is, but the pirate does not know what the state is. Okay. He might have some information about what the ensemble in general, but he doesn't know the exact state. Okay. But if he sends it right back without copying, then the banker is going to be able to perform some kind of measurement here and accept the state, we'll say with probability one. Okay? Because the banker knows this index I. He knows what this is, so you can perform this corresponding measurement and accept it with probability one. Okay, so money is verifiable. But if he sends two back, well, basically the most general thing you can do is create some kind of joint state. Might be entangled or correlated or whatever. But there could be a state in this guy, in this guy's head, and they could be correlated. They may not be like a product state. And what the pirate wants to do is make this inner product large. Okay, so this is the probability of accepting the first bill. This is the probability of accepting the second bill. So this is the probability of accepting them simultaneously, given this state tau here. So any questions about the setup, what it means to counterfeit? OK. So here's the security idea, is that if you have a hard time counterfeiting one, or let's say cloning one ensemble, it should be harder to clone 9, or 10, or 11, or however many you want. Okay. So this is the idea, mostly the quantum idea. So this alpha n here, let it be the success probability of cloning n ensembles. Okay. What we would like is the best thing you can do for n ensembles is to optimally try to counterfeit each one independently. Okay? This is the case in quantum theory. It was proven in 40 years later in 2012 using semi-definite programming. Okay? So you can imagine, let's say you're just given a state from two different ensembles. You could ask the question, should I optimally clone this and this? Or maybe there's some kind of joint strategy. I'll take them both in and output something. And maybe I can succeed with higher probability this way. Okay. So you can always do at least as good but just by doing them independently. But maybe you could do better. Okay? So in quantum, you cannot do better. And this decays exponentially in the number of ensembles. In the GPT case, we don't have this anymore. So we can get this under some assumptions. So if you have some kind of assumptions under the states or the measurements or the cloning machine, then you can get this equal exactly. But we don't want all these assumptions, so we're going to throw them all away. But we could just say if there exists an ensemble that you cannot perfectly counterfeit, then the success probability of cloning n of them will decrease exponentially. Okay. So what's neat about this is that there's no middle ground. It's either the case that you can counterfeit any ensemble the bank throws at you, or you can have, which is like zero security, or you can have practical security, where you can decrease it to an arbitrary constant. Okay. And I'll explain how to do this in the GPT setting. But any questions at this point?
What's the notation?
Negligible. Yeah, it's just decreasing exponentially. I didn't want to write down exactly what it is because it's nasty. Okay, so that was the idea and the result. So now we can actually write down a cone program. So with probability pi, you're going to be given the state si. You're going to throw this into your cloning machine, get two copies out. Well, ideally two copies out, but you're going to get a system that inputs k, and you're going to get this bipartite k tensor k system out. And then you're going to give it back to the bank. The bank is going to accept both copies of this probability. Okay. So we're going to optimize over channels now. So the channel looks like this. It's going to be trace non-increasing. Okay. You can think of it as trace preserving, but a little bit more general trace non-increasing. And it has to be a valid GPT channel. Okay. So valid GPT channel, I'm going to kind of sweep all the details under the rug and just say it's convex. But the idea is that it has to map physical states to physical states. Okay. So, or if you want to think in the Heisenberg picture, it has to backwards preserve measurements. Okay. So if you think of it as acting on a measurement, that new thing has to be a valid measurement as well. Okay. So there's a couple like convex conditions. We're just going to wrap it up into this neat cone. Okay. And this is what John did. He wrote it like this. So there's going to be a few slides. This might help some of you. I'm going to explain this notation. Okay. So now we have a channel. It's going to input a state, output two of them. It's going to live in some convex cone. This is trace non-increasing. Okay. So this is kind of like throwing away the discarding effect. So you input a state, you apply the cloning machine, and you just trace out what you get at the end. And it has to be less than just tracing out at the beginning. Okay? So it cannot increase the trace or, say, the probabilities that are going to be associated with the state that's coming in here. Okay? So in this case, we do have this is going to be an affine constraint, or sorry, the hyperplane constraint, but there is an inequality here. So instead of a hyperplane, it's going to be a half space, so everything underneath as well. And C here is going to be what the bank is doing. With probability pi, it's going to prepare the state si. It's going to be fed into the counterfeiting machine. And then it comes back, and it's measured with the same effect here. And the effect just depends on I. But we're going to kind of wrap this up into the neat C here. So C is the bank strategy. And this chi is what the pirate is going to use to counterfeit the money. OK, and we can look at its dual cone program again. Right here, we have some state here, y, and then we're just going to throw it away. So this is basically, we're going to minimize this kind of normalizing factor of y here. And we have y. And so this is the state y. This is discarding. This guy has to be larger or equal to the original bank strategy c in relation to this cone here. So this is the dual cone of the counterfeiting machines. Okay. And this little e up here, which is the effect cone. So this effect has to be smaller than this effect. So this y here has to live in E star. And E star, you could think of as kind of like physical states. Okay? It's comparable to K. So that is the picture version of the dual cone program. What we're going to do is relax it now. So remember I said the probability of counterfeiting N ensembles did not exactly equal to the probability of copying 1 to the power N. What we're going to do is we're going to lift it up to something that does decay exponentially. Okay? So we're relaxing this E star here to K. We're not assuming they're equal, which is the no restriction hypothesis. We're just lifting it up. Okay? And now this y here lives in k, which is a physical state. So this y here you can think of as a physical state. Okay, so this is a nice physical operation. Okay. Any questions with this? Okay, so here's the idea. We've relaxed the banker. We've relaxed it, and now we have this larger strategy. Okay. And we're going to use this larger strategy instead of the original one. Okay? So we're going to replace the banker with a new banker in order to upper bound how much the original banker could be cheated. So using duality theory, we're going to use this new strategy. So we're going to replace this banker with this banker. Okay? What does she do? What she's going to do is insert, she's not even going to choose it probabilistically, she's just going to insert this GPT state here. Okay. There's going to be some scaling factor, but don't worry about that right now. So there's some state there. She gives it to the pirate. The pirate is going to make two copies, send the two copies back, and then she's going to throw them out, and that's it. Okay. She's basically just going to accept anything that comes back to her. Okay, that seems counterintuitive, but this is going to be, this is basically what happens from duality theory. And here's the kind of the key idea, is that you cannot cheat this banker. If you have some strategy to counterfeit one ensemble or two, it doesn't help having some kind of joint strategy because she's just going to throw everything in the garbage anyway. So there's no way you can cheat her. Okay. And the probability of cheating that banker decays exponentially. So I swept something under the carpet. Whenever she created the money, there was a scaled version of a GPT state. And the scaling factor is exactly the amount you're going to cheat her. Okay? And the scaling thing just, if you have like n ensembles, the scaling factor to the power n is how much you can cheat her. So it gives you, from duality theory, so both of them have the same idea. From duality theory, you're getting this new strategy just popping out for free. And then we see if you use this new strategy, what happens. And this is exactly what happens.
Sorry, just to check understand a bit of it. Yep. Started from the duality theory, where we have the maximum equal to the minimum, when we did the minimization over the full cone.
Over the effect cone in that case.
Cone. Yeah. So now you're saying instead of minimizing over the full dual cone, we restricted the minimization to a subset.
We're actually relaxing. So, so we had alpha is the probability of cheating the original banker, and then we relaxed it to this kind of alpha tilde, which is saying that the cheater can use, what is it? Instead of being restricted to E star, he can use anything in K. Or the other way around. But it's a relaxation.
K is the dual cone.
Yes.
So K must be smaller.
Oh, one second. That's right, sorry. It's a restriction because it's a minimization problem. It's
so
okay.
The minimum will be higher.
That's right.
Okay. So this means that solving the minimization problem inside the cone of actual effects will give an upper bound on the cheating probability.
Yeah, so if you use the cone of effects, you get the actual cheating probability.
Yes.
And now we're going to relax it to something something non-physical by saying instead of putting E there, we're going to put K star there. Or instead of E star, put K. And it's giving the cheater, how do we think about this? It's giving the cheater more power algebraically. Physically, it doesn't mean anything, because anything outside of, you have k and you have e star, and anything outside may not be physical. But we're going to kind of think of it as physical.
Sorry, so are we going outside e star then? I thought you were going to k that was inside e star.
Right, we have e star here and we had k. Right, yeah, so we're going to look inside here.
Okay.
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be, since we're restricting and but we're minimizing, the value is increasing.
Yes.
So we have an upper bound. Mm-hmm. But you can prove that if this is less than 1, then this is less than 1. And this thing does have the nice product theorem structure, mm-hmm. that if you have n copies in the new probability, mm-hmm. then with n ensembles, it's going to go to the power n.
So the one with the product property is...
Is the non-physical one, the one with the tilde.
So non-physical is that. K is the set of actual effects. Star is the conceivable effect, so, according to the non-restriction.
Yeah, maybe I should watch how I say physical numbers.
The primal is formulated for the GPT channels, which is in K. Right? So the dual, physically, is in
So, no, the primal involves E.
Primal is...
Yeah, that's why the dual is E star. So now I remember what I meant by non-physical, is what you're going to do is you have these channels that are trace non-increasing. And you have this condition that this is less, this, maybe I'll just go back to it. So you, right here. So this thing has to be less than, in the effect cone, the discarding measurement. This is what trace non-increasing means. Now, if you change this e to k star, you're allowing him to use more general cloning machines. But now, since the cloning machines satisfy a constraint, it's more general, it's not physical. That's what I meant. Yeah, so the non-physical argument happens in the primal, not the dual. That's where I was going to mix it.
Okay.
So this is a relaxation in the primal, restriction in the dual.
So should that be E from A to AA, or should that be K?
Right here?
Yeah.
So this just means that it's mapping a physical state in A and outputting one in AA, A tensor A. This just means it's preserving all the structure, the cones, whether it's the measurements or the states. But this is the part that means trace non-increasing. Basically, it means you have another thing inside a cone, and they add up to something that is trace increasing, and you kind of wiggle it around a little bit. And you just say that this thing has to be a larger effect than that. Trace non-increasing, if I just tell you, and then I wrote this down, it's not immediately clear why that's what captures it, but you have to think a little bit. Oh yeah, this is great pun animations, okay. Okay, yeah, so you're upper bounded by something that decays exponentially. Okay, in quantum theory, this relaxation is this alpha tilde equals alpha. Because we have the no restriction hypothesis, which is satisfying quantum theory, then these two values are the same. So in quantum theory, if you do this proof, it's quite a bit cleaner and fewer lemmas are needed. Okay? So it's a little tidier. Okay. Okay, so this is something interesting. We assume the cones are closed. So for the forgeable money, we required that the cones were closed. Okay, I'm not sure if we require this. It could be, you know, if we had a more clever proof, maybe we can get around this. But some people don't care whether the cone is closed or not, because you just like, okay, this theory is characterized by experiments. Okay, you have some kind of states, you have some kind of measurements. So whether or not you're allowing things on the boundary of the cone or not may not affect experiments, because you can only do finitely many experiments anyway. Okay. But I thought it was interesting because our results required that the cones were closed. And it could be if the cones are not closed, you could not have unforgeable money. Okay. So this, I think, would be a very large operational difference of whether the cones are closed or not. So I don't know. It's just something I like to think about. So some people have cones as being closed as an assumption, but it's the only assumption we make. OK, so quickly just go through some future work. So coin flipping, which is a slightly less useful but stronger crypto task than bit commitment. Okay, that's what I would like to look into next. I don't really have time, so I'll just go through that. So with bit commitment, you can do coin flipping, but not the other way around. Okay, so coin flipping is quite interesting. Oblivious transfer, that's another, it's a universal cryptographic primitive for two-party cryptography. So we have Alice and Bob. Most of the time, if you want them to perform some task, you can break it down at the level of oblivious transfer. Okay, so oblivious transfer is very interesting for cryptographers. GPT fully homomorphic encryption. Okay, I wanted to put this in. It's a bit of a joke. No, it's not a joke. This, including on the slides, a bit of a joke because even classically, this is a hard thing. Like people are still working out what this means classically. Basically, it means that you have some kind of encryption of your data. You send it somewhere, and they can perform some kind of logical operations on it without decrypting it first. Okay, so you kind of encrypt the operations, and then you have, and then you can perform it on the encrypted data. So the data is encrypted the entire time. Okay, but the idea behind quantum homomorphic encryption, which is something that's just being done in the last few years, is that you have to one-time pad a GPT state, or a quantum state. So I was just curious if you can one-time pad a GPT state. I don't know. So in the quantum cases, you apply a random poly operator. Okay, and this will completely hide whatever qubit you have. Okay, or in the classical case, it's just a regular one-time pad. Delegated GPT computations. So this is basically what I just said. Suppose you want to send your information to D-Wave. They're going to just solve it for you. But you don't want D-Wave to know what your data is. You don't want them to know what problem they're actually solving. Okay. And classical GPT-resistant cryptography. This is something else. So this is what you mentioned, Ravi, at the beginning. So this is what most people consider post-quantum cryptography.
This will be post-quantum.
Yeah, exactly, post-quantum. I think post-quantum cryptography should be called post-classical cryptography. But anyway. So this is a very interesting problem. So you have a basis of vectors, and you want to look at its lattice, which is generated by all the integer combinations, integer linear combinations of these two things. Okay, so you're going to get a nice lattice of discrete points, and you want to find the shortest vector. Okay, this is an extremely hard problem. Okay, so classically, the best algorithms run in exponential time. And we can't do any better in quantum. Okay? Just like an RSA, what makes RSA secure was that Adelman, the A, you know, took the proposal and after a few days couldn't break it. That's why RSA is secure. Okay? Because this.
After a few days.
So they kept giving Adelman, I can't remember the first two names, but they kept giving Adelman some different say factoring-based crypto systems, and he kept breaking them.
Oh.
You know, after half a day or a couple of days, he'd break them and break them and break them. And after a while, they gave him something that he couldn't break. So no one could break it, and it's secure. That's how classical cryptography works. This is secure because Oded Regev can't break it. So therefore, no one knows a quantum algorithm that can break this. Okay, that's how crypto works. Okay, so finding the shortest, this is the shortest vector problem. And it'd be interesting to see in any kind of generalized probabilistic theories if this ends up being easy. Okay. But this relies on algorithms and GPT framework, which is probably pretty difficult. OK, I'll just say this quick. So optimizers have a bunch of interesting cones. They've been thinking about cones for a long time. Physicists have been thinking about cones. Okay, and I think it'd be really interesting to see if the two communities have solved problems that the other people care about. Okay? You know, I talk to John now and then, and John's like, oh, I wish we had a cone like this. I'm like, oh, yeah, we have these things. They're just, he's like, oh, that's neat. And I'm like, oh, I wish I had a cone that did this. John's like, oh, yeah, physicists have been doing this for a while now. You know, so I think it'd be really nice just to open up a branch of communication between these two different areas and just seeing what pops out. Okay? You don't even have to do any more work. You just kind of translate the different languages. So I think that would be very nice for future work. Okay? So summary, GPTs are interesting. Hopefully you still believe this. Cone programs are useful. Big commitments, still impossible. Unforgeable money, still possible. And there's more stuff to do. And that's it. Thanks. Questions?
Your code closure condition. Mm-hmm. The step where you relax the problem, are you assuming code closure on the relaxed version? Or? I think of closure as a relaxation. I don't see why it would be necessarily constrained on the real theory.
It's in the relaxed, I think. Yeah, so whenever I'm relaxing E star to K, I want K to be closed. E star is already closed. Every dual cone is closed. So I want the set of physical states in that case to be closed.
So it's on the dual side, like on the primal side, it was a relaxation. On the dual side, it's a restriction.
That's right. Yes.
So which side are we talking about? Like if we're on the primal side and we're relaxing, and then we require closure of the relaxation, then I would say that doesn't have any physical significance. On the dual side, and we're talking about closure of the restriction.
So what I want to do is relax this E to K star.
Right. And okay. I take the closure of K star.
No, I take the dual of K star. So when I take this really should be the dual of the dual, K star star. Because whatever cone shows up here, you put a star on it whenever you go to the dual. Okay. And I want this to be K star star is the closure of K. So the fact that I put K here means I'm assuming that K is closed.
Then it does seem to me that if E is strictly smaller than K star,
this argument, K being closed doesn't come into this argument, actually. That's right. It was, if the original probability was strictly less than one, then we want the relaxed quantity to be strictly less than one as well. And we needed closure there. If you don't have closure, it could be that there's no, the optimal solution to this gets arbitrarily close to one without actually getting to one. If it's closed, you can say like it actually stops at some point. So if you're optimizing over a closed convex set, it's closed and bounded, then it's compact, attains an optimal solution. And once you have an optimal solution, the optimal solution is bounded away from one. But if it gets arbitrarily close to one, then everything breaks down. So that's where we're using closure, just so this optimization attains an optimal solution. It's not the most interesting way, but yeah, I thought for some time trying to remove this, but it doesn't seem possible. So in terms of counterfeiting money, if the counterfeiter maybe spends more and more time trying to counterfeit, like a more elaborate strategy, and the more time they put into it, they can get closer and closer to perfectly counterfeiting. Something like that if the cone's not closed.
So what are the hypotheses that go in the proof
For the money?
Yeah, for the money.
Only that the cones are closed.
Finite dimensional.
Presumably the proof should not work for classical theory, no?
Right. So right here, we're assuming there exists an ensemble. They cannot perfectly counterfeit.
Okay, so that's...
Sorry, I should have said this. We call it the weak no counterfeiting.
Yeah.
So in classical, you can counterfeit every ensemble. So for classical, you can't have this. Now, if you want to assume a couple other assumptions, if you assume enough assumptions, so you have a no cloning theorem. So I think this is no restriction hypothesis and a couple others. And if you have some kind of assumption on the bank's measurements. If the bank has a measurement that will uniquely pick out the state, saying, OK, you give me the state, there's an effect that will uniquely pick it out, it'll accept a probability one. But any other state, there's some positive probability of rejecting. If you have this assumption as well, then this will be satisfied. So there's a couple of physical assumptions that we can put to make this satisfied. But basically, we're just assuming this, and then you can ramp up the security.
Is it true that your result is more general than just saying that you have a no cloning theorem?
I think you should. It's kind of a quantifiable version of no cloning theorem. This is the way I think about it. Like you have some kind of operation that's going to judge whether or not you've tried to clone something. So it's weaker than no cloning because you don't need, it could be the case that you cannot perfectly clone, but you can still perfectly counterfeit. Because you don't need perfect. But perfect cloning will imply that you can break this. This will equal one. That's right.
Something I found a bit confusing about the way you presented the cloning of money and the way that the bank operates. So clearly the bank can't have just a single quantum state that it puts into every dollar bill. Like each dollar has to be distinct from every other dollar somehow. Is that right? Like presumably they'd have like a serial number.
Yes. So that's the idea, is that there's a serial number and then the bank records the serial number, records the state that they put into that, and then when it comes back for verification, looks up the serial number in big database, finds out what the state should have been, and then performs that measurement.
But it sometimes reuses serial numbers, or?
Yeah, so this is...
You're implicitly, the bank is testing the same.
Right, so this is kind of a proof of principle, whether or not GPT money can be made secure, but it's definitely not practical. Like a bank does not want to verify money like this. So the one reason around the serial number is that you can imagine a bunch of different banks, maybe not communicating, okay? And you send one bank note to one bank, and you send the bill to another bank. And then they're independently, the measurement is still going to be the same, the tensor product, they're just gonna be like space-like separated. But they're still looking up the same serial number and doing the same measurement. More sophisticated schemes in the quantum regime is whenever you have like a store merchant who can verify the money. Or sometimes you measure the money yourself and then communicate classically with the bank. So this was like the 1970s version of quantum money. And then there's been a bunch of nice work in the last 10 years or so that's saying, hey, look, we can do these more realistic settings.
Yeah.
But that's very hard in the GPT setting.
Not sure if you already said this, but like the primal and the dual can sometimes have a gap.
Yes.
And like, do you know you don't have this gap?
Yeah, so one thing I didn't say is we're assuming that these cones have non-empty interior. So basically the vector space, they all live in some vector space, and the vector space they live in is the span of the cone. So it's the states comprise of a full dimensional convex set inside. And once you have this non-empty interior, then you can be guaranteed that you have no duality gap. So the primal, let's say it's optimizing, it's coming up here. The dual's minimizing. They could have a positive gap, but under the assumptions that I didn't explicitly state, they're going to be equal. Yeah.
The trick used in Bitcoin trade-off in GPTs, which is take Bob's cheating strategy, look at the dual problem, mm-hmm. and somehow use that state analysis cheating strategy.
That's right.
Where does that trick come from? Like, who's the first person to do that? And is it the trick that we use to get the best bounds, like you mentioned, for example, in the quantum case, if you have multiple mm-hmm. rounds of commitment, and in the coin flipping case, is it a generic trick that gets us the best bounds in all these cases? Or what?
No, it doesn't. As far as I know, the optimal one in the interactive case doesn't boil down to this. So usually what I do is I take an STP I'm familiar with, and then I kind of boil it down to the very, very, very raw essentials of what's needed for the proof. So this particular proof is something I've been looking at Bickman for many years. And I've looked at many STPs, and I basically boiled it down to this very, very simple proof. But the idea behind this proof is comes from these papers by Giulio and company, Bo Combs, or there's John Watrous and his student Gus Kotowski have this strategy paper. And they're able to look up, they have these strategies, and you look at them as some object, just some vector, usually by taking Choi-Yamakoski representations, whatever. And then the thing that interacts with it ends up being a vector as well in the dual space. And then the inner product gives you these nice probabilities. So in this case, whenever you have, if you drop the interaction between Alice and Bob cheating, it's whenever you write down the STP in a nice way, the dual will give you the thing that interacts with it. Sorry, I said that very poorly. But if you write down the STP in a nice way, the dual will give you everything that the other person's doing. So in this case, whenever I wrote down the STP for cheating Bob, it gave you something that Alice could use. When I wrote down the STP for the counterfeiting, for the pirate, the dual ended up popping out something the bank could use.
So why is that? So I've got like an honest Alice vector, her strategy is the honest strategy.
Yeah.
Cheating Bob vector.
Yes. And if you have a no restriction hypothesis,
yeah.
Then if you look at the set of the dual to Bob.
Dual to Bob's cheating is sort of a cheating vector for Alice.
It'll be something physically possible for Alice, which you used for cheating.
So where's the intuition that that should be a good cheating strategy? Like, that's what I'm kind of missing. Like, is there some... it's not obvious to me that even though I could think of it as a strategy for Alice, why it would give me any kind of good bound when I assume that that's what Alice is doing. Because now I have to imagine that Bob's the one who's being honest and Alice is using the strategy.
Yeah. So if you look at the constraints, you can see that this cheating vector for Alice satisfies some nice properties and that they're kind of larger than the honest states in some way. So algebraically, why it's a good strategy comes from the dual constraints. But why it's a good strategy in general, I'm not entirely sure. I've thought about this, and I have some other settings as well where the dual kind of magically gives you something. And I really want to know what this something is in these different contexts.
Well, if there was a kind of symmetry between Alice and Bob, that somehow the kind of cheating opportunities for Bob are dual to the cheating opportunities for Alice. Like, if the problems they have to solve are somehow dual to one another.
Yeah. If you started with cheating Alice in big commitment and you took the dual, you would get a strategy for Bob.
Right.
I believe that's true. So, but that's what's happening. It's just I can't really put my finger on why the dual solution should be. It's not always an optimal solution for the other party, but it's always a decent solution. It always gives you this constant trade-off.
Maybe there's restrictions on, maybe there's certain kind of restricted protocols where the strategies have been defined carefully so that the duals give you the optimum. Like maybe there's sort of a symmetry relation between strategies such that they're kind of dual to one another. And in those cases, you expect the dual problem to be the optimum. Kind of an interesting thing.
Yeah.
It gives you something nice at all.
Yeah, and there's some neat things going on that I can't really put my finger on. But yeah, I agree, it's quite interesting.
Terry Rudolph and I were working on this a long, long time ago. We sort of did conceive of Alice's problem in certain kinds of protocols. I think we called it state control or something like that, but it was kind of dual to state discrimination. But, you know, it was kind of just a kind of an analogy.
Yeah.
These results suggest that there might be something, some sort of more formal notion of duality.
Right. In that paper, you had different definitions of what Alice may want to do to cheat, right? If I remember correctly. Like, you had different definitions of her controlling the bit. Just
different from...
Like, you had numerous trade-off curves. Like, Bob, I think, always just wanted to learn the bit, but I think Alice had different ideas of controlling. Remember in the paper you have like 8 different trade-off curves.
The different trade-off curves were not different
There weren't different else's?
It was more like a qubit was one trade-off.
Oh, and there's pure states.
Qubit was another.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And so some of those curves were, here's what we can actually achieve with qubits and qubits, and others were just, here's a, like what you had, a kind of trade-off relation that we provably could show no quantum protocol could do better than.
Right, right. Okay.
So, did I understand correctly that to get your no-go result, you took Bob's optimal cheating strategy, then you took a particular cheating strategy for Alice, which is not optimal, and which depends on Bob, sort of knowing Bob's cheating strategy?
So we didn't take Bob's optimal strategy, we took a formulation of his optimal strategy. We said, here's an optimization problem which captures cheating Bob. We took its dual, so we took that problem, kind of turned it on its head, came up with something algebraically kind of equivalent but different looking, and an optimal solution in the dual. And the optimal solution in the dual ended up being a decent strategy for Alice. So it's a little more subtle than what you said.
The probability that you calculated of Alice successfully cheating was assuming an honest Bob then?
So we took cheating Bob, but we just wrote down cheating Bob in a funny way. It wasn't in terms of his optimal cheating strategy inside the protocol. It was inside this dual idea of a cheating Bob. So he took this dual Bob, if you will, an optimal strategy there, which corresponded to an okay strategy for Ellis.
I guess I'm not asking about how you got it, but even just the statement of the result, like, some probability of success at cheating for Alice.
Yes.
Is that under the assumption that Bob is behaving honestly? Or?
Yes. Oh, yes, 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 yes. Whenever Alice cheats, Bob is honest. Yep. When Bob cheats, Alice is honest. Yep.
I'm wondering if you could read up. Consider a totally different problem, which mm-hmm. is consider a kind of a state discrimination flavored problem.
Okay.
Maybe not the usual one of, you know, guessing the probability, optimizing the probability of guessing correctly, but just some sort of state discrimination problem.
Mm-hmm.
Formalize it as a cone program, take its dual, and then try to re-describe that as another task, right? Like a state control task.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way of constraining the state discrimination problem such that the dual really becomes an actual description of a task? Because I don't think this was the slide, but when you described the dual cheating strategy, it felt like there were some sort of unphysical elements in it. Yeah, here. Is this it?
Let me put up both.
Yeah, that was right. So I'm trying to read the right-hand side as a new, don't think about a Bob cheating probability. Think of this as a kind of, we're just trying to define a new task
mm-hmm.
where somebody prepares a state X and there's some sort of win criterion or success criterion that involves a pair of states, SP0 and SP1.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so maybe something like you've got to sometimes steer to SP0 and sometimes steer to SP1 or, you know, something like that.
Yeah.
Can I do that here? Like, is this describing a task already, or and if not, what's preventing it from describing a task?
Yes, that's a very good question. Usually whenever I have a quantum problem, I write down the SDP, and I write down the dual,
yeah.
And then I usually sit there for some hours thinking, what the heck does this mean? In this case, it's not clear what this means from an operational point of view. You want to minimize the trace of X such that X is still larger than both of these guys, and the vectors might be a little different. So, you know, algebraically, it's kind of clear what's going on. But if operationally, like why this has anything to do with state discrimination, like unless you go through this kind of journey, writing down the primal, then taking the dual, it's not clear. To say another way, if you give me the task and I just told you this was the cone program that captures the probability, I wouldn't be able to argue it, I don't think. Like, it's not clear what structure this has that pertains to that task. If you wanted to change the task and massage this around a little bit, maybe you want an ambiguous state discrimination, or you want some other kind of discrimination, you can add the constraints there, then take the dual and see what's going on here. And then they'll be equivalent in some sense, but kind of skipping this dual taking, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure you understood me or whether I'm just not understanding your response. But I guess I'm just wondering whether if we thought about it hard enough, we could recognize the math here on the right-hand side as just, you know, some state preparation task. So X is clearly a normalized state, okay? And so I'm wondering, is there some description that says, you know, your task is to prepare an unnormalized state, and sometimes I'm gonna ask you to maybe resolve it into a mixture, one element of which is SB naught, or else I might ask you to resolve it into a different mixture, one element of which is SB1.
Yeah.
What's the maximum normalization of state such that you could do this, or something like that?
Yeah.
Feels, it sort of has that feel to it.
Yeah.
And if we could do it with that, then it seems to me it's like, okay, we've identified the quote state preparation task, which is the natural dual of the state discrimination task.
Yeah.
And then if we understood these dual pairs, like, okay, start with unambiguous discrimination, figure out what its dual is, then we'd kind of have a dictionary.
Mm-hmm.
We could try to, you know, maybe write down new tasks that involve two-part cryptography where we kind of design them so that the cheating strategies of Alice and Bob are kind of matched.
Yeah.
That, like, you know, Alice's cheating strategy has to be one of these state preparation tasks that's dual to the state discrimination task that Bob needs to do to cheat.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that these tricks you're talking about will be optimal trade-offs for such tasks.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that'd be very interesting. Yeah, I agree. It's not clear, but it's interesting. You have to think about that.
Okay, one last quick question.
So, going on that, you had the slide like what John did to my beautiful entities. And I find it quite interesting that you can take diagrammatics and, like, take the dual of a cron program that's written using diagrammatics. So that could, like, explain the kind of things you're looking for. I have this problem, I write it as a diagram, and then what's the dual of that? But instead of having a bunch of matrices, I have another diagram.
Right. That might help figure out what task you're describing.
So that's an observation, but the real question is, like, how much of this is formalized and how much is, like, you pattern matching after the SDP?
Mm.
And we've write down an algebra that would apply on diagrams, for example, to do this.
I think that last bit, an algebra.
Okay, is there like algebraic rules that would work on like on the first thing? It has to be the second thing because blah.
So one thing I'll comment on that is that suppose this is your vector that you're optimizing over, lives in this space, takes an input, has an output. If you want to look at in the dual, you're basically looking at inner products, and whenever you calculate adjoints and all this stuff, you're basically looking at the actions undertaken these inner products. Now, what does it mean to take the action or the inner product of something like this? It basically means you have to stick something there and you have to stick something there because you're getting a number out. And this is exactly why whenever you're given that kind of structure, the dual vectors have this kind of structure, such that they fit together. Julio's work on Combs really kind of this really pops out. So that's why you kind of have this duality between how one person interacts, and in the dual, it's how the other person interacts with that person. So after a while, after I warmed up to these crazy diagrammatic pictures, it made it very clear what was happening. This is why the original proof in the quantum case did not have this other strategy. It's purely algebraic. They said, here's an SDP, here's some vectors, we put them together, product there. Ours is a physical argument. They say, look, we have this other strategy that has this nice property with this C. It's a physical strategy. If the bank used it instead, we can upper bound how much they can cheat. So it's a physical argument. And it just popped right out from these pictures. Like, if I wrote it in my with just vectors, it might not have been so clear how to make this work. Or not so readily, anyway.
One more question.
Thanks.